we have PowerPoints and we've got things that are going on behind us while I'm teaching. Then there's pictures to be looking at, and there will be pictures after the service if you all want to be looking on Dina's tablet or in the laptop. We can open that up and turn it on. But this year, we're going to take a different approach, and we are going to let you into our lives and take a deeper look into our hearts and the things that go on in us that you might not be aware of. And so the goal for this trip this year is really to connect with the body of Christ, those that we have been sent out by. And so there's different churches, you know, that are supporting us, and we feel connected to each fellowship. But you don't always know what's going on in our hearts. Sometimes when we come back, you almost feel like you're doing a sales pitch. We're not doing a sales pitch this year. We're letting you see a deep and intimate part of our lives and be very vulnerable with you and share some of the things that we've gone through in the last couple of years. So with that said, I'm going to turn it over to Dina, and you're going to get an opportunity to hear from her, to hear from the kids, and we'll see where it all goes from there, okay? So God bless you guys.
Okay. Sorry, getting older, need lots of different glasses. That doesn't work. So anyway, good morning. My name is Dina, and we've been serving in Belize, Central America, for 6 years now. Is this on? Are you hearing me? Oh, it just sounds so normal. Okay. supposed to be echoing or something. Like Patrick said, he kind of took a little bit of the speech I was going to start with in that, but I guess this will just let you know that we're kind of on the same page and God's confirming things with us, because like he said, normally we do the presentation and we feel like, you know, we're just kind of coming and almost like a business thing going on up here. And we found that after we get back to Belize and the years go by, we've lost connection with the people, and we miss you guys, and we want to be missed, so you can't miss us unless you know us. And how many of you guys have ever seen us speak here before, like know who have met us before? Wow, quite a few, okay, but a lot of new faces. And how many of you know a missionary family personally? I mean, besides us. okay. So, that's not very many. So chances are you're not really familiar with what goes on in the mission field and what it's like to be a missionary. When Pastor Augie asked us specifically if we would have the kids share, we've never done that before. So it was kind of like, wow, what a great idea. And so we started kind of practicing with them, and it just turned into this sort of family presentation so that you all get to know who we are and what it's like in the mission field. Before I have them come up, I'll just give you a little bit of background on what it's like in Belize culturally, so that as you hear them share, you can kind of understand a little bit what they're talking about. Belize is a fairly small country. It's about a little over 300,000 people, and it consists of the Hispanic people from all the surrounding nations. It used to be a colony of Britain, so there's some British, you know, descendants there as well. And then also some shipwrecked slaves that mixed with some Indians long time ago created a people called the Garifuna people. They're predominantly on the coastal areas. They focus a lot in like witchcraft and voodoo and animism and things like that. That with the Hispanic people, we see a lot of Catholicism as well as the old Mayan animism and different the beliefs that they bring kind of mix it in. We saw that in Mexico as well. That was predominant in Mexico as well. And so then we also have a Mennonite community out there, which are German descent through Canada, but from Germany to Canada and then down into Belize. So there's quite a population out there as well. So it's very multicultural. But what we've noticed after being there a while in Belize is that it's very religious. A lot of missionaries have gone to Belize, whether it was through the Mennonites or different religions. But mostly what we can see is they brought religion. And people, the Belizean people have learned, because of the poverty there, they've learned that as the missionaries come and they bring us things, if we behave a certain way, if we do what they tell us to do, then we'll get that free stuff. You know, they'll take care of us. They'll provide for us. And so it's kind of created a nation that's dependent and kind of has an entitlement mentality, you know, toward missionaries. Well, we'll come if you're going to give us things. And so when it comes to the spiritual repercussions of that is that there people tend to not have much of a relationship with Jesus or with the Lord. It's all about religion and kind of wearing the mask, coming to church on Sunday, performing, putting on the mask, and then they go home and they've got split homes, unmarried family or unmarried couples, child abuse, alcohol abuse, poverty, all those things. And so the Lord isn't really changing anything in their lives. So that's kind of the focus that we're working on is mostly discipleship. But so as the kids come up and share, that kind of gives you a background to know what it's like for them to live in that culture. So let's go ahead and have all of you guys come up. I just want to introduce you real quick. And I apologize. We started early for them. We came from Olympia, so they were sleeping in the car, and they're a little bit, okay, maybe you should line up in the front here, like youngest or smallest to biggest or something. Okay, here we have, in pink, this is our newest addition to the family. This is Keisha, and we just picked her up. We've been having her in our home and loving on her since Christmas. And on weekends and holidays, and we just picked her up Friday the 13th to stay with us permanently, so we're very excited about that. She's 7, and this is Chase. He's 7, so these are my twins. Don't they look alike? Yeah. They're 7 and 7. So this is Keisha. This is Chase. This is Kylan. He's 9. This is almost 10. This is Jaden. He's 13, almost 14, and this is Caleb, 17, almost 18. Some of you have known him since he was just a baby, so they do grow up. Now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to have some of the little guys. I'm just, please bear with us because they've never done this before, and they're all, like, nervous and feeling weird about it. So what we did is rather than have them just give a speech, I'm going to kind of interview them and just ask them some questions so to help them out. So, Chase, what? Here, come on back. Let me come up by you. Okay, come back here. Okay, so what's your name?
Chase.
Chase. Okay. Where is your home?
Belize.
Belize, okay. Who are your friends? Who are your best friends?
Brothers.
Your brothers? Anyone else? You have any Belizean friends?
Jabez.
Okay, he said Jabez. But his other answer was his brothers, so you'll learn a little bit more about that as we have them share some more. What are your favorite things to do in Belize?
Play.
Play what?
Play.
Play what? What do you play at home with your brothers?
Soldiers, knight. Legos.
Okay, and what do you play on the TV?
Xbox.
Okay, so point is they're normal kids, okay? They do all the normal things. Actually, we just got the Xbox last Christmas. It was a family present, and, yeah, it's been a blessing. So let's see. Okay, school. What do you do for school? Where do you go to school?
Home.
At home. We homeschool, right? Okay, and what's your school uniform look like?
Clothes.
No, tell the truth. What's your school uniform look like?
Clothes.
Truth is, he does school in his boxers, okay? He's pretty much barefoot and in boxers all day long until winter comes around. So we were kind of laughing about that the other day. That's our school uniform. Okay. Good job, buddy. Okay. Kylan. What's your name?
Kylan.
Say it louder.
Kylan.
Okay. Kylan. All right, so where's home for you?
Belize.
Belize, okay. And who are your friends?
Chase, Jane, Caleb, Chase, brothers, Javis, and some other peoples.
Okay. Let's see. What are your favorite things to do at home?
Play Xbox, play Legos, playing soldiers, play blowing up stuff.
Okay, let's give them an example of some of your sounds that you can do. Pretend you're shooting something.
No.
Come on.
No. We have to hear this all day long.
Let's hear it.
We have a friend in Belize that's been living with us. He's actually a Ugandan man, and he calls it pew-pew-pewing. He says, Kylan does nothing but pew-pew-pew all day long. And we're trying to watch a movie maybe or trying to have prayer time or family, and he's walking around and blowing everything up all the time. Okay. So is life pretty normal for you then?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Good job. All right, you three little people can sit down and relax for a minute. Okay. So that's Kylan, Chase, and Keisha. Okay, now for the big boys. They have been in the mission field much longer, obviously, and have experienced a lot more. So starting with Jaden. Jaden, what's your name?
Jaden.
Sorry, I just have to do that because I wrote it down. What's your name? Okay, where is home for you?
Anywhere you guys are.
Anywhere we are. Interesting. Okay. Okay, so who are your friends, Jaden?
My brothers and Kennedy.
Kennedy. Who's Kennedy?
My friend.
Where's Kennedy from?
Belize.
Yeah, but ultimately he's Guatemalan, right? He came over from Guatemala. But his dad is Scottish, or his stepdad, so that's an interesting mix of people. Let's see, what are your favorite things to do in Belize?
Hang out with my brothers and sometimes play pew pew pew.
Okay, we weren't going to admit that because he's getting older now, but
Xbox and stuff.
Okay. And
and youth group.
Okay. And what do you do for school? Where do you go to school?
Obviously home.
Okay. Do you like school? Okay. See? Normal teenager. Okay. So Jaden, tell me, what's it been like for you living your life in another country, another culture?
Kind of hard.
Hard why?
Because it's hard to relate with the other kids.
Cultural differences?
Yeah.
Yeah. So what makes you able to relate with Kennedy?
I don't know.
Maybe because you've known him since he was pretty young and you guys just kind of been growing up together, so he knows you better. Okay. Am I missing any questions? Okay. So, Caleb. Oh, okay. About. Okay. Okay. What are some of the cultural difficulties? What are some of the differences you see in the young people in Belize versus compared to you and your life?
Well,
what kinds of things do the Belizean youth like to do?
Well, they like to play ball, football, and basketball. Yeah.
How are they with that?
They're not good teamwork.
They get pretty competitive and kind of aggressive. And yeah. Okay. What about their spiritual life? How do you notice the youth, especially the youth that come to church and stuff?
Not that good.
What are some differences?
Well, like whenever they go to church, they put on a happy face and pretend like, oh, yeah, God's my Savior. So, and when they go out to play ball, they start cussing and stuff.
So would you say it's difficult for the youth in Belize to live for the Lord? They kind of compartmentalize their relationship with God? Okay, cool, good. You want to sit down or you want to stay here? Support your bro? Okay. So Caleb, what's your name?
Caleb.
How old are you?
Almost 18.
Almost 18. How many years have you been in the mission field?
8.5. Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah. Where else did you live besides Belize?
Mexico. And the States.
And the States, okay. How was it in Mexico for you? What was one of the biggest difficulties in Mexico?
Not being able to communicate with people.
Yeah, that's a big one. Okay. look at my questions. I'm forgetting. Okay, so where is home for you?
Well, wherever you guys are, I guess.
Okay, I don't know if you guys are catching that, but that's kind of as we were asking the boys questions for today, we were finding out that they get kind of confused about where home is sometimes because they've been moving around the world. And, you know, especially when we come here and people say, oh, welcome home. For me, because I spent most of my life here, it kind of feels like, oh, I'm home. But for these guys, this is not home for them at all. So their home is somewhere else, except for the fact that wherever we are, I guess they feel like they're at home. So let's see. So who are your friends in Belize?
These kids. I have a friend named Melvin, a couple years younger than me. And
how close have you and Melvin been able to get?
Pretty close, kind of hit and miss here and there.
Yeah. Has it been a struggle because of cultural differences?
I guess, like, in the beginning it was, but as we got older and, like, started to understand each other a little more, then it got easier.
Okay. What's it been like for you going through your teen years trying to make friends in Belize?
Not very easy because all the, like, differences we have, Well, I'm white, apparently, to them. And I'm American, and they just, you know, discriminate, kind of. And, like, look at you as, like, an outsider or outcast or something like that. So it's kind of difficult that way.
Okay. So it's been hard to get close with people. They don't really, haven't really let you in very much, right? Okay. So what about coming home or here, not home for you, but what about coming back to the States? How is it for you guys as teenagers coming back and seeing your friends that you know from time to time, usually over Facebook, and trying to connect with them?
Well, it's kind of different still, because, like, they grow up with each other and stuff, and like, I'm away most of my life and stuff. So it's like, when I come back, it's like kind of more harder to, like, to, I don't know how to explain it.
Like an outsider.
Yeah, still an outsider.
Okay.
And, yeah, I just kind of don't feel like I fit in much, really. Because, like, here is different from, like, where I'm usually at. And so, yeah.
Something that I want to interject here for you guys, because we're trying to show you a pattern here, a theme here, is for MKs, okay, missionary kids, is they are third culture kids, all right? Their origin is in the States, but they live in another country, all right? They live in Belize, or we've lived in Mexico. But they don't have roots in either place, all right? For what Caleb is communicating here is in Belize, he's treated like an outsider, right? That's how they are treated. And in America, they feel like an outsider. It's not necessarily that they're treated like that, but it's a matter of perception that way. And so for them, when the kids are coming back to the States, there's a difficulty that's going on in their mind and in their hearts as they're struggling with relationships in their host country and they're struggling with relationships in their home country, and it's hard to reconcile the two. And so it can be a very difficult, challenging time on the mission field and while visiting in the States. And that's kind of what we're trying to show you guys. And you might not realize that, especially like Dina said, like when people will say, well, welcome home, or does it feel good to be home? And they might have a puzzled look on their face, like, well, I'm not home. My home is more in Belize. And so that there's some difficulty going on inside of their heads and in their hearts there.
Okay. One last thing I want to give Caleb a chance to share about, and I'm going to kind of lead and direct him through this because we've talked about it a lot. But So Caleb, again, how many years have you been in the mission field total?
8.5
8.5 And so in the time that you've spent in the mission field, what are some things that you've seen in the world that have influenced who you are today? What are some of the greatest things that you've noticed around the world that have molded and made who you are today?
Well, what I've experienced, like, I see a lot of pain in people and poverty and kind of hopelessness towards life, kind of. And it just kind of saddens me just because, like, all the hopelessness.
And what does that hopelessness look like in the people?
Like, just look down and, I don't know, sad. They turn to, like, drugs, alcohol, and other stuff, gangs a lot, and, yeah, something like that.
Okay. And what else have you noticed? That what have you seen in every culture, that in every third world culture that you've been in, that has really motivated you?
Injustice. Like,
okay. Well, we've experienced a lot of the people, their pain and their suffering comes from, you know, the way other people are treating them, whether it's the government and the corruption in the government and things that the government does that keep the people down. And just a lot of crime. Belize is pretty much a culture of gang life and crime. We just 2 years ago, after we returned home from our furlough, we had a team that came, and right after the day after that team left, we were robbed in our house at gunpoint. And I won't go into all the details right here right now, but it just kind of tells you that the culture that Belize is, it's all about thieving and stealing, and you know, there's no sense of a value of life, really, that people are just willing to, you know, murder for the slightest thing. And so that's kind of the culture. But so as we see, you know, people robbed or you know, people murdered or you know, people hungry or whatever the suffering is, the injustice, I think has led Caleb. He's experienced a lot of it. He's seen a lot of it in his, you know, growing up, and he's always had a real sensitive heart toward wanting to help and rescue those who are suffering, which typically it's the children, you know. As we see adults make the choices that they make, it's the children that always end up suffering because of it. And so we've seen Caleb grow up with just a real heart to want to rescue people, you know, whether it's through human trafficking or child abuse or whatever. That's just, so it's been interesting for us to see how that specifically comes from his experience being in a third world all of his life and seeing what people have to live with, and he just wants to right those wrongs, you know. We've noticed that. And so what kinds of things are you praying about or thinking about doing in your future now that you're almost 18?
Well, the first option was, like, going to, what's that place called? Potter's Field. I don't know if any of you heard of it. But yeah, that was my option. Open up.
Okay, Potter's Field is like a discipleship ministry where then you go and serve in the mission field, serving kids and stuff. So it's a year-long program.
Or the second option that I'm kind of heading to now was joining the military and going into the Navy. Hopefully becoming a Navy SEAL if I can make it that far.
Okay, so anyway, we've just seen how the way that the Lord is calling him and moving him is directly related to what he's experienced in his life in the mission field. So, okay, boys, that's it. Well, that's our kids, and sorry. Chasey, you can sit up, honey. A quick note on our kids, you know, I've read a few articles that are at a missionary's website. It's a support website for missionaries, and getting encouragement from other missionaries. And one thing that really ministered to me when I read it is that this article was about a little girl who struggled with having to leave home and go to the mission field, and people would say, come up to her and say, how does it feel to be, you know, called to the mission field and to be called to be a missionary and everything? And she would just get confused, and eventually she went up to her parents and she said, but Daddy, I don't feel called to be a missionary. It was her parents that were called to be missionaries, and that really opened my eyes about our kids, because, you know, we've been in ministry for a long time. We've been in the mission field for a long time. We drag these guys with us everywhere we go. They do everything that we do, and yet sometimes I struggle with, should we be making them do these things, because we don't want, they're not the missionaries, we are, but yet they're a part of our family. So the way I see it is that they are not called to be missionaries right now. They are called to be our kids. So sorry, I didn't know that would happen, but I'm trying. These guys, I just can't help it, because I have been so blessed. You know, Patrick calls these boys his deacons at church, because they are with us every Sunday, every service, every youth group, loading up the vehicles, transferring the equipment, setting up for church, cleaning the church. They do it over and over and over without complaining. And we don't make them do it. They're just willing to serve. And I'm just so proud of them. You know, we've seen missionaries have to leave the mission field because of their teenagers. You know, kids reach those teen years, and it's hard for them to be away from home. And especially with Facebook, you're always reminded of everything that's going on back home, and you're not a part of it. And it's hard. They make a lot of sacrifices. And so I'm just... Sorry. They know how much I love them. It's just hard when you talk about it. It brings out the tears, because they're my heroes. And they've sacrificed a lot. And I am just so grateful that each one of them knows the Lord. Each one of them loves the Lord. And we haven't lost them being in ministry and being in the mission field. And that's been our goal, is to try to get through ministry and through this life that God has called us to without losing our kids. And the Lord, this is kind of leading me into what I wanted to share about, because in the last couple years, I guess, as we've been trying to figure out what is our focus of ministry in Belize, what the Lord is really leading us to and putting on our hearts heavily is children, the children of Belize. We've been discipling adults, and we've been ministering to adults, and we still will continue to do that through the local church. But where we really want to put more focus and more work is in the children. We've seen that it's very difficult, even as people come to Christ and they start being discipled, it's very difficult to change cultural patterns and old ways. And so what we want to do is start to focus on the children. And, you know, years ago, I had great aspirations or great ambitions that I wanted to do with my life, and all these different things that I thought, okay, well, I'm going to put this on hold, you know, so Patrick can finish Bible college, and then we had kids, and you know, someday when I get through all the kids stuff, I'll do this great thing that I thought God wanted me to do. And it was always in my head that way. And then just recently, the Lord, you know, we've been taking a counseling class, and it's put on by a Christian from out of a Calvary Chapel in Southern California. He's a missionary in Belize, and he's been in the mission field for, I don't know, 10 years or more as well. And he has he focuses on counseling, addiction, and abuse and things like that. And he works with a ministry in Belize that rescues children and women from human trafficking and counseling and getting them back into their life and everything. Well, he started teaching a two-year program in Christian counseling and counseling addiction and abuse. And so we started taking the class, and we found out that going through the class, we are really getting the counseling ourselves, much-needed counseling. And our Ugandan friend made the comment as we were driving to our final test day, He said, "Pastor, I now see that everybody needs counseling. Every person in the world needs counseling because it really makes you take a look at yourself, why you are who you are as we do our homework." But one of the things that the Lord showed me is that my priorities were wrong because I kept thinking, you know, oh, I'm doing this great thing by putting off all those things I wanted to do in order to raise our kids and be with our kids. And now the Lord is showing me, no, it's not that I put off the great things. It's that my great thing was the wrong thing. My great thing should have been the kids, because we have one shot in this life, in this world, to introduce them to eternity. You know, every child in this world that is born to us or that we receive, it's our job to make sure they know their Creator and that they have a relationship with Him and that they're in eternity with us. Because what good does it do us if we serve the Lord and we work our tails off and we work our jobs and we do all these things and then we go to eternity and our children don't? You know, I have to say this because I did not grow up in a Christian home for many years, and I still hear my mom say to me, "I worked all those years so you could have all those, so we could have all those great things, the vacations and the boats and all those things." And I thought to myself, I don't remember those things. I just remember I was a latchkey kid. I was home by myself. And so the Lord has really, I guess, as I look at my own children, and the Lord shows me that there's nothing more important than making sure that they know the Lord, whatever it takes. That is first. But not every child has that. And I look around at the children in Belize, and not every child in Belize has a parent that tells them that they love them. Not every child in Belize has a parent that feels that love for them, that's there for them physically and spiritually. And so it breaks my heart, I guess, when I think about all those children that are being abused, that are being neglected, that don't know the Lord, and they're coming to church, and they're seeing us interact with our kids, and they're seeing us love on our children, and they're asking us, "Can you take me home with you?" You know, we have children, you know, everywhere that are asking to come with us all the time, and so we try to bring them on weekends and, you know, and spend time with us. But so that's my heart, is that I want to love on every child that I possibly can. I want to make sure that as many children in Belize know the Lord as their Maker, that they love them. And one of the struggles that we found in trying to you know, with the Belizean people, sometimes they've never received love. They don't know what love looks like. They were raised, you know, with abuse or alcoholic parents. They don't know what love is. So when we try to tell them, you know, let's worship God, the one who loves us, to them it's just, they don't understand it. And for many of the children, they don't understand God's love for them either, because they've never seen love before. So my heart is that through ministry, we can love them like they're our own. And that's another lesson that God is teaching me lately, especially with, you know, our recent addition, is that I have a love for every child, and whether they're mine or not, I want to be their mama. I just do. I want to raise them, and I want every child to know that they are loved by somebody because I love them. And so the way that I want to do that, or that we want to do that, is through Sunday morning lessons at church, obviously, teaching them the word, spending time with them. But what I've noticed is that Sunday morning is not enough, because they go back home, and what they have at home looks nothing like what God is teaching them in the word. And then they go to school, and the public schools, which are only semi-public, really they're mostly private with a little bit of government funding, there's a lot of chaos, and there's a lot of fighting, and there's a lot of, it's just craziness. And I've watched some of the little kids that I've had in Sunday mornings who used to come and behave so well, and they could memorize the scriptures, and you know, we're just doing so well. And then once they start school, within a year or two, they're coming, and all they want to do is fight with everybody. And so they're so influenced by the culture around them and by what's going on at home, that the simple Sunday lesson is not, it's not enough for them. And we really want to disciple. We know, you know, when Jesus discipled people, they followed him and they spent much time with him. And so what we want to do is start an after school program where we can have the kids coming every day, spending time with them, teaching them, helping them with their with schoolwork if they need it, and just encouraging them, being parents, you know, to them. I know I can't bring every child into my home, but the best way that we found to really disciple them and make a difference in their life is to spend as much quality time with them as we possibly can. So that, unfortunately, to get to that point where we can do the after-school program, we need more people who can help staff it. And what we're noticing is that, you know, right now it's been hard to count on too many adults in the community, whether it be because they have to work so much to support their families, or they're just spiritually not ready. So we're praying, asking God, you know, send us interns, people who could commit to maybe a year and serve for a year with us, or missionary families to come, somebody. We're giving it up to the Lord and say, Lord, we need help. We have a lot of children to reach. We have a lot of work that needs to be done. I will let Patrick share a little bit more about how we're going to do that. So anyway, that's where I'm at. That's my heart. I hope I made sense to you. I'm just shooting off the cuff, but without writing it down. So anyway, here's Patrick.
All right. Well, you're getting hopefully you're getting a little bit of a view of our family. I've been thinking a lot lately about this a question I have, and the question that is repeatedly rolling over and over and over and over in my head is this: is the church a safe place? Is the church, the body of Christ, a safe place for people? And what I mean by that is, we all got baggage. Right? We are a broken people. We're a hurting people. We suffer. We have pain in our lives. And oftentimes we carry this stuff around inside of us. And we hold on to it. And we're afraid to let it out because we fear. We fear being found out. We fear rejection because we've been hurt before when we opened up ourselves and it was used against us. And so we build up these walls around us because we don't want to be hurt again. And sometimes, you know, it's hard to be vulnerable with each other because of our fear. And for me personally, the church should be the safest place where we can be real, where we can take down the mask, where we can drop our guard, and we can let people in. You know, if you think about it, Jesus came to seek and to save the found. Is that what he said? The lost. He came to seek and to save those who are lost. You think about the people that he chose to be his apostles. Were they the cream of the crop or the bottom of the barrel? And we can relate to them, can't we? Sometimes I wonder, you know, if when we're coming to speak at churches, I ponder is what do people think of missionaries? And I got this thing that rolls into my head. I think, well, are people thinking, well, they, you know, they're preaching the gospel and you know, hundreds are coming to Christ. You know, the demons are running as you walk down the street. Your shadow passes by somebody and they're healed. I don't know where that is, because that's not my life. That's not been my life that I can recall ever. We are coming out of 2 years of darkness, right? A very dark and lonely and scary time for us. Dina had mentioned the robbery a little bit, and I had sent out some emails and I had shared some things in newsletters. But reading about it and experiencing it or trying to explain it you know, reading about you don't get it. Because there were so many emotions and there's so many difficulties and so many trials that resulted even after that. See, the last 2 years wasn't just about getting robbed, right? There was a subsequent events after that ripped us apart. Just ripped us apart. See, after we were robbed, we were on a massive adrenaline rush. Right after the guys had left, okay, just to give you a little insight, what happened was I was ambushed in our lower field. Our dogs had cornered some guys. I went out there thinking it was just some kids, and I was met with a .38. And they turned me around and they marched me up to my house. And Dina, she saw what was going on. She screamed. She ran and she grabbed the cell phone, was very wise, and she started calling 911 and started calling all the friends that we could get a hold of. And these guys, they were looking for our laptops, looking for electronics. How they knew about it, I don't know. We suspect that there was some inside information that was given to them from church members. And as I was being robbed, I was watching this guy. I was just looking at his face while he robbed me. And then finally he said, "Quit looking at me." And then he knelt me down by the couch and he put his pistol on my head. And I didn't know what was next. And then it was over. They were gone. We had people respond very quickly. And the manhunt was on. And I started getting information from church members that they were saying, "Pastor, we saw some guys fitting that description. They're passing this way." And I'm giving this information to the police, and the police are totally disregarding me, and then they're ignoring me. And then they finally say, "Go to Belmopan and make your police report. We'll take care of this." But I keep getting this credible information. And I decide, no, I'm not going to Belmopan. We're going to go do our own investigation. And we started going to one witness after another, after another, and after another. And before long, we've got the names of three people. We've got we've got where they are from, who their families are. We've seen people watch them walking down the gravel road to get to our house and then not coming out that way. And so finally, we get a phone call from a neighborhood watch person. They said that the main gunman, we know his name at this point, his name is Trevor Lamb. He's walking into the village, and he's got something bulky under his shirt, and it's probably one of the laptops. Well, I went back to one of my friends, Rick, who owns a store. He's always armed because he was robbed as well, and he shot and killed a guy. And his friend is also armed, and he's got a shotgun. And I said, "Rick, the main gunman, he's going into Ontario Village." And he said, "What do you want to do?" I said, "Let's go get him." I said, "Let's go." And so we all leave. We go in our vehicle. And understand, like I said, we're in a massive adrenaline rush. We're making stupid decisions because I've got my wife and my kids with me. And I've also got two other church members with me. We make our way there. We call the police, who have already gone back to Santa Elena and to Belmopan. And they say, wait. "We'll come. We'll meet you there." So we go, we park outside the village, and we wait. And when the police arrive, we all go into the village from different directions, and we form a noose. And as I'm driving through the backside of the village, I drive right by the main gunman, and I identify him. So that's him right there. And so we turn around, and we start to follow him. He's about 100 yards in front of us, and he and his friend, they disappear behind a box truck. And Dina gets frightened and says, "Patrick, don't go, because we don't know where they're at and they might come out and shoot at us." And so I held off for a minute and waited, and then finally I figured it gave enough time for them to continue on, and I pulled out. And right as I pulled out, we heard pop, 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 pop. And it wasn't us being shot at, it was the police shooting him. They shot him in the arm or leg. We're not sure where he got shot. And then they rushed him to the hospital and he went to jail. It wasn't till the next day that I broke. That's when I finally wept. And we fled our home. We left our home for 6 months. Or 3 months. I can't remember how long. We were gone for a while. Trying to figure out what just happened. Lord, what are you trying to teach us here? And it was the loneliest time for us because we didn't have much interaction with people back in the States. And, you know, as I said, we're coming off two long, dark years. And we realized, like, our sending church, they had never experienced this, and we had never experienced this. But we've learned some valuable lessons that we're trying to communicate to churches that are supporting missionaries and that are sending missionaries. And one of the main things that we have learned is that when a crisis happens, don't expect and wait for somebody to ask you for help, because they might not know what to ask because they're not in the right mind. They might be in shock. And I think that's part of what was happening. Is people, they were expecting us to ask for help. But we didn't know what we need. We were just trying to maintain something. We did. Our life was turned upside down. And so one of the things that I'm trying to communicate to different churches, you know, when you're sending out missionaries, you got to stay in contact. You got to stay connected. Because the missionaries who go out from the churches, they are an extension of the body of Christ that is here in the States. And it was the loneliest time, and that was part of our problem. The next part of the problem was, like I said, we think it might have been an inside job of people in the church. People who had been in our house, they knew our stuff. Because the robbers, they only stole two laptops. And the couple that was riding with us, they were from the village. And they helped us. They knew the guy, they knew the names, they identified. The guy said, oh yeah, that's Trevor Riders, I drove by. But the next day, we had gone, and we were staying with some friends out in the Mennonite village in Spanish Lookout, and Dean and I were running around. She had to go make her police report. And we kept getting phone calls from the young ladies who, because that night, they had said, well, Pastor, we'll stay at your house. We're not afraid. I was like, that's fine. I didn't know what was going to happen to my house. But another interesting conversation had taken place in the midst of the investigation was that the young man that was with us, he asked us, well, Miss Dina, what about Caleb's computer? And we had completely forgot about his computer, and his computer was in his bedroom, hidden and tucked away underneath blankets and clothes and stuff, and we hadn't even taken it out of there. It was there. And I knew that the robbers hadn't gone there because when I had my head down, I knew exactly. I had one man behind me with a pistol on my head, and the other guy was in the kitchen walking around the living room. And he never went down the hallway, and he never went into another room. So we knew that that computer was left in that room, untouched. Everything's still piled on it. So this couple, we said, yeah, go ahead and stay here. That's fine. So the next day they're calling us. Well, Pastor, where are you? We're explaining, you know, and just kept getting these strange phone calls. We get back that afternoon. We're going to do service that night, Wednesday night. We got robbed on Tuesday, Wednesday night. The young man that stayed there, he's going to drive the church bus for me. We walk into the house, and we're packing up clothes for the kids so that we can, because we're going to stay out in Spanish Lookout for a little while. We pack up their clothes. We walk into that room, and the clothes are all thrown on the ground, and the computer's gone. And we're like, oh no. And we got frightened. Because we were wondering, were these guys involved in the entire thing? Because they had been in our house prior to us to coming home, because I had asked the young man to drive down to pick us up at the airport. And the other family that was living down the hill on the property, they had given them the keys to our house, and they'd gone in before we'd even gotten home, saying that they were going to clean it. That night I make an announcement, kind of bringing people up to the date, and then I say, and I don't know if this was the right thing to say, I still to this day, I don't know, I made some mistakes, I'm sure, but like I said, I'm not in my right mind. I'm running off adrenaline, I'm running off of emotion, and I tell the church, you know, we were robbed, stuff's gone. I said, and now today the next computer's gone. Wasn't robbed when we were robbed at the time, but now it's gone. A couple immediately afterwards, they come up, Pastor, we don't know what happened. And we're like, well, you're the only ones in the house. We don't know what happened either. We moved out to Spanish Lookout, which was about 7 miles further from us, about 18 miles from the church, and we stopped our bus route. Couldn't afford it. We had been for a long time supporting that ministry through our personal finances, but our finances had been slowly decreasing and decreasing and decreasing. We said, I can't afford this anymore. And now I'm not sure what the people that we're picking up around here, what their motives are, what their intentions are, because they're all related. When I stopped my bus, I lost half my church. Imagine one Sunday morning, this half of the church just being gone. And you start feeling like a failure. You start wondering, I've been giving my life and pouring my life into these people, and this is how I get treated. But I know somebody who was treated the same way. And he said, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. I struggle with that. Maybe you do too. Forgiveness is not natural. It's supernatural. But still, it's hard. So now we're living off our property. We don't know who to trust. We've lost half our church. And then prior to our coming home, we had just returned from furlough. Prior to coming home, we had had a young man who was staying at the house to watch the house for us and to feed the dogs. While we were gone on furlough, he was stealing from us too. We had given specific instruction to him. You may not have your girlfriend out here. If she does come out, she must come out with your family. We made it very, very clear to both of them, to the family. But we loved these guys. Young just had so much potential. They're driving and abusing my car when I gave him specific instructions after he dropped us at the airport. Go home and park it. I'd paid for his insurance. I paid to license his vehicle. But he beat mine all up. We had stuff stored up above that had been donated to the church. Gone. Dina's jewelry and perfume. Gone. And I'm wondering, Lord, what are you doing? Why is this happening? Am I in sin? Did I not hear you? And you start playing these recordings in your head, trying to figure it all out. I want to read you one passage of scripture. First Corinthians 4, 1 and 2. Let a man so consider us as servants of Christ, an under rower, a slave who is in the bottom of the ship that is rowing the boat, getting that boat to the destination as the captain of the ship calls out the commands and says, to this destination we will go. Let a man so consider us as servants, an under rower. That's all I am. That's all that Pastor Augie is. We're under rowers, ministers, heeding the call of the captain of this ship, the church, and stewards of the mysteries of God. A steward is a household slave that is entrusted to the affairs and the estate of the master. We're stewards, a household slave, a lowly servant, entrusted with the responsibility of overseeing the household, overseeing the belongings, but nothing belongs to him. What is the church called sometimes? The house of God. The family of faith. So the minister is to be a household slave, a minister to those in the house. And here's the one I really want to nail down. Moreover, it is required Note that word. Required. It is not an option. This is an absolute necessity. Nothing else matters. This you must do. It is required in stewards that one be found faithful. Faithful. Not successful. Faithful. I don't know how many times I feel like a failure, you guys. I feel like I blew half my church away when I cut out that bus route. When I had to confront sin, man, I got told some pretty mean things, and so did my wife, that you're a failure as a shepherd. You failed as a shepherd. You didn't take care of your sheep. Why do you call yourself a pastor? But not called to be powerful, but faithful. Not called to be eloquent. And remember, the problem with the church of Corinth is that they were positioning their pastors. Well, I'm of Paul, I'm of Apollos, and I'm of Cephas, and I'm of Christ. And so they were comparing all of their ministries to one another. Let's not compare ministries to one another. Let's not compare our pastors to one another. And us as pastors, let's not compare our ministries and ourselves to other pastors and ministries. Because we are called to be faithful. Faithful. Faithful to those whom God has entrusted into our care. And it doesn't matter how many. Because God does not spell success S-U-C-C-E-S-S. He spells success F-A-I-T-H-F-U-L. Because it is required of a minister, of a steward, of an under-rower, of a household slave to be faithful. And that's where we stand today. It's faithful. Forgiven. We make mistakes. I've made mistakes. But I've tried to be faithful. And that's where we're headed. You know, we haven't lost hope. We could have ran. We pondered running. Trust me, we're like, we didn't sign up for this, Lord. But the Lord's like, Patrick, I never called you to an easy life. I never called you to a comfortable life. I called you to live a faithful life and an obedient life. And the best place that we can be as Christians is right smack in the center of the will of God, wherever that will might place us. The circumstances, the situations, the trials, the tribulations, and the struggles. That is the best place to be. Faithfully obedient, fulfilling God's call in each one of your lives. And that's where we will continue to head as a ministry, as a family, as a husband and wife. Father, I want to thank you for this morning. I want to thank you for the attention of my brothers and sisters, Lord. And I pray, Father, that you will take all the things that they have heard this morning, all the things that they have received, and that you will take the seeds that have been planted and root them firmly in their hearts, and that you would produce growth. That you would produce good fruit, God. Father, I pray for the anointing of your Holy Spirit upon Pastor Augie and upon all those who minister here and upon this congregation. God, that you would empower them and that you would equip them and that you would send them as a force to be reconciled with in a world that is dying and perishing, Lord. I pray, Father, for Calvary Chapel Gresham, Lord, that they would be the light of the world and the salt of the earth. That you would give them a boldness and a passion and a fervency for the things of God as we approach the coming of the return of Christ. Lord, let us redeem this time, not in fear and in trepidation, but in faith, faithfully obedient to the call and the will of God in each one of our lives. I pray these things, Jesus, in your matchless name, Lord. And all God's people said, amen.